This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 167 of the USDF's official podcast. I'm Chris Stafford, and on this week's episode, we're going to be hearing from USEF Senior Dressage Judge and L Education Program faculty member Debbie Ryle Rodriguez, who will talk about flying lead changes. And we'll also have part four of our series on the mind-body connection with Sandy Veneman, but that's later on in the program. First of all, a reminder that the views of the host and guests of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDF or its members. And we begin with some news. US Equestrian has announced the 8th annual Robert Dover Horse Mastership Clinic Week will take place from January the 2nd through the 5th, and that will be held in Wellington, Florida. This clinic is designed to identify and develop the next generation of US equestrian team talents, and participants can expect to receive instruction from experts on a wide variety of aspects of horsemanship. Training sessions will feature mounted sessions led by internationally acclaimed American athletes and trainers, and daily instruction on all facets of horsemanship from experts in their respective fields. The week will conclude with participants riding their tests in front of the judges and getting feedback from coaches. And 18 athletes who have met the criteria will be invited to participate. And there will also be four wildcard spots. If you're interested in applying for a wildcard, you should contact Hallie Griffin, U.S. Equestrian Managing Director of Dressage, at hgriffin@usef.org. And the deadline for that application submission is November 15th. The public is welcome to audit all of the mounted sessions for just $25 a day. Well, joining me now is a USEF S judge and an L faculty member here at the USDF, Debbie Real Rodriguez. Debbie, welcome to the program. Your first time here.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're going to talk today about the flying change. It's something, when it happens perfectly, it is just poetic. It's just absolute harmony and seamless, and it looks wonderful. But it doesn't start off that way by any means. Let's talk a bit, little bit about when you should start to introduce the flying change, Debbie.
Okay, well, when the horse has been able to perform a clean, quiet, simple change of lead where they're going from a canter to a walk to a new lead based on what the rider's asking for, then everything should flow. The horse starts to show a little bit of greater degree of collection and balance so that he's able to then perform the lead when the rider asks for it. There's a lot of little issues I think we can talk about, but basically if a horse can also do a little bit of counter canter, I usually try to encourage riders as soon as the horse feels like they might be ready to start. Some horses are just pick it up really easily. Other horses, if the rider stays with the counter canter for several years, by the time they go to ask for a flying change, the horse really is hoping firm that they have no idea what they want.
Of course, the next part of this scenario is not only when you start, but where in the arena you start. What sort of things, tips and tricks do you have for our listeners here, Debbie, as to how to make this, the first introduction we're talking about, you know, to build the blocks on from there?
Well, I have several different exercises that I like to use, and it really depends on the horse at that time, the horse's mentality, their willingness. If they're a little bit hot off the leg or if they're really dull horses. So I'll use different exercises based on that horse's personality. But if a horse is rather sensitive and has been prepared correctly, chances are you could ride a short diagonal or a long diagonal and aid for a change in the corner, and the horse would be able to do it. But as we know, that probably doesn't always happen the way we'd like. So various exercises work for different horses. So one of the ones I like to do, I use figure eight with starting with doing a really quick change of lead through the trot when they come through the middle. That's one way. I like to use a 20-meter counter canter circle where I'm asking the horse to come from the outside lead to the new inside lead, which is a comfortable place for them to go if they understand the aids there. And I find that's a good way to maintain control of the horse if they get a little bit excited, because you've got the use of the circle at that point. I also think doing them from half pass is a good idea. The horse helps to change a little bit more behind if they've got the hind legs under them a little bit more. But again, it's just different, depends on the personality of the horse. If I find one that is particularly lazy or is not going to be estimating a clue what they're going to be doing, I'll usually use a little pole on the ground, or I'll set up a low cavalletti, and then I'll try to ask the horse to do the flying change as they're making a change of direction over the little jump. And that seems to work really well, as mostly as a last resort, but it really does help them to get a clearer picture of what we're trying to do, because the jump actually helps them make them jump through.
Let's talk about the rider's approach to this, because maybe there's a rider out there that's never done it before, who's got a horse that's capable of it and needs to know how to teach this correctly, and maybe anticipating it, and even the experienced riders, there's always that moment of anticipation and the body language that goes with it. So talk us through some tips there to help the riders in that stage of learning or teaching the horse the flying change, Debbie.
Well, that's a good question. Mostly you're right about the anticipation, because if a rider has never done them before, of course, the ideal situation would be to have a more experienced person try to get them started, because as a rider who is new to this, they can end up making a lot of mistakes, and then the horse can learn some bad habits early on. So I really highly recommend an experienced person maybe start first time or two with the changes, and then be able to be there to guide the rider through as they're going with it. But in the event that they can't, basically the rider is just simply going to be asking for reversing their aids, as if they're going to be bringing the new inside leg forward, the new outside leg back, make a little change of bend, and then hopefully something happens when they do it. But I really would suggest having an experienced person to do it the first time or two in that case.
And of course, it's not going to go seamlessly. So what are the sort of things that get in the way of that process, I mean, the kind of issues that you have to deal with, and those that may be annoying, because you don't want bad habits to start at that early stage in the training, do you?
Correct, because it can be so hard to fix. But yes, the most common thing, I believe, is going to be the anticipation or the tension that's going to be created at this point, because being new to the horse, especially if the rider is green with it, the rider's going to be unclear with their aids, and then the horse may not get the full message that they're trying to achieve here. But I think getting a horse that changes leads clean is going to be a main priority here. And sometimes the horse will change clean easily on one side and not on another. But taking the time to really develop correct changes from the beginning is so, so, so important. But horses can learn to get a little strong. Some of them get a little wild and buck, possibly, through the changes. Some of them might get excited and bolt off. Some horses are just going to break to the trot and then pick up the new lead. You can have a variety of issues with the flying changes, and until the personality of the horse really tends to kind of determine what kind of reaction you might get if they're a little hot or a little bit too laid back. But in either case, it's really important to establish that horse jump through clean behind, because that is a hard thing to fix.
And I know it's very tempting, if it's getting better and better, that you might want to try it again and again. What is a good place to stop? How often should you try and teach this at the early stages then, until it's established, Debbie?
I think different trainers have different opinions on that, because some think once you've started the changes, you should just routinely continue with it every day, every day, every day. I feel like, again, depending on their personality, if I ask for it and I get it, I'll probably quit for that day, thinking this is exactly what I wanted, reward the horse. One or two, if it works, then I'd back off for it. I do think, like I said earlier, it's important that the horses learn to get them when they feel ready and they're comfortable with it. So if you've got a young horse and you're just out riding one day and you feel like, well, this might be a good time to try a change, I would certainly put them in there. I don't feel like you have to be working on second or third level in order to put changes on the horse. I like to try them, see if it'll work, and then sort of put them in the bank, so to speak, for bringing them back out later when you might be going to back through the levels and coming up and having to do some counter canter. You don't want the horse doing the changes at that point, but you want to know that they're sort of stored in the bank so that when you do get to that level and you need them, they'll already be there.
Okay, so let's take it to the next step then. They're ready, you need them, you're off to your first competition. Give us some ideas of the things that riders, if they've not ridden it in a test before, what they need to look out for to make sure it is confirmed in the test.
Right. And this can be a really interesting process because riders are nervous. They anticipate horses get nervous at the show, a little bit more exciting situation. And sometimes you never know what's going to happen at third level where we first start to see introducing the flying changes. We can see a variety of issues happen, and they can be anywhere from, like I was mentioning, bucking, bolting, swinging the haunches from side to side. The rider wants to make sure that the horse is going to respond when they ask for a change, and then the horse kicks up or they swing their haunches. But I think the main thing is, in the event that it doesn't, it's kind of a tricky situation, but the best thing I think is to just go on with it, do the best you can. If you're asking for a flying change and nothing happens, just drop to a trot, drop to a walk, settle the horse, pick up the new lead and go on, because you want the horse to be confident and not rattled just simply because they're asking for a change. And it can happen to the best of riders, even with horses that might be a little more confirmed in the changes. You get out there and something's going on in the background there. The horse is distracted and the rider is aiding for the change and the horse's mind is elsewhere. And sometimes things just don't always happen as planned. So you have to kind of just go with the flow. But the one thing the rider should not do in a competition is try to circle back or start again, try to make it happen again, because, of course, that's going to count as an error if they do that, and then, of course, the change may still not happen. So there can be a lot of circumstances that will determine whether or not, you know, the horse is going to be responding at that moment. But if it doesn't happen, just continue on and then hope you can get the next change.
Good advice, because it is often that one movement, isn't it, both in dressage and in eventing, that a rider can become quite unraveled by if it goes wrong, because the horse may be, as you say, a little bit upset, and it is just a state of mind then. You have to just settle down and say, okay, that's behind you, we'll take it back to the training barn, not into the arena.
Exactly, yes. And then for the rider to know basically what the judge is thinking in their mind, if the horse, for instance, just does a change that's late behind, but everything else worked and maybe he comes through a couple strides later, well, that, of course, is going to affect the score. And in most cases, it's going to be an insufficient. But then if you have other issues going on, that's going to keep bringing the score a little bit lower and lower. And I think a lot of riders figure, well, you know, if the horse breaks, they're going to get a 4. But that's not the case. If the horse does not show a flying change, most likely they're going to get down to a 1 in their score. Because if you consider a horse that just does a change that's late behind, then that's looking at a 4. And if you get perhaps a horse that kicks up or tosses his head and still changes late behind, then we're kind of looking at a 3. And if you get something else going wrong, you keep going down from there. But if the horse does no flying change whatsoever and then just breaks to a trot, of course, that's going to unfortunately put them down quite low to a 1 or a 2. So the riders need to understand that the scale for judges depends on that horse's reaction in that moment. And it's really important as a judge that you're consistent with everybody and not just give a 4 for a late change and then a 4 for a little kick up or a 4 for a break, because there's a lot of differences in those, and that's a big range of scores. And it's only fair to the other competitors that the judge score the poor one accordingly.
Well, that's explained the scoring a little bit at the lower, you know, what happens when things go wrong. Let's talk about what it looks like when things go really nicely. What kind of score can they be hoping for?
Yes, that's a really good question. It really a lot depends on the quality of the canter that the horse has to begin with. And ideally, the horse has a nice big uphill balance, a good ground covering canter. The horse shows like he almost has a bigger stride through the change than in his regular canter. That would be the 8 or the 9 or even the 10. The horse should look just totally effortless, totally straight, totally on the aids, and really cover ground with no hint of being tense or overreacting or swinging the haunches. Those are the qualities that we want in a really good change. That the word that we like to use is scope, a lot of volume, a lot of ground cover with that change. And horses, if they just do a nice, quiet, pleasant change, your average horse, most of those are going to get a 7 if it's a clean change, which is fairly good. And then it's the quality and the scope of that change that's going to bring the score up from there. And if you have a horse that has perhaps a less ground covering canter, he's a little bit short, then perhaps that's going to be in the 6 range or a 6.5 range if it's clean. And then, of course, we go down from there. If he does a change, but some really issues are not quite right, then we're looking at 5. But at least if it's still clean, you know, he could be crooked, he could be a little tense or a little fussy in the bridle. Those things sort of designate how you're going to start to go from there. But, of course, that quality, that 8, 9, 10 change, the 10 change, I can't say that I've ever really seen except for maybe Charlotte on Allegro. But it's really, you know, it's just, like you said, poetic when you see it done correctly.
So if you're driving home and you're talking about having a 9 and flying changes, then you're going to be a very happy rider at the end of the day that you've achieved that.
Oh, that's for sure. You got that right.
Any other advice, Debbie, finally, on establishing the flying change?
I think that's off the top of my head. That's pretty much what I can think of. Just trying to, you know, take your time with these and not to rush the horse through the changes, to really get them solid before you go out and compete with them. Because so many people, they think, well, I got 1 or 2 at home, and then they go to a show and there's just no way it's going to happen. And I really see, unfortunately, a lot of times where the horses are changing late. I'm not sure the rider is always aware of it, but if that's the case, they shouldn't go on and be doing tempi changes if they don't have solid established single flying changes. And in 4th level, where you do start some several tempi changes, this really is going to start to really hurt in your training. You really want to take the time and establish those clean flying changes from the beginning before you get out there in competition.
Very good advice. Debbie, thank you very much indeed for coming on the program and unpacking that for us. Thank you so much indeed for your time. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Now in our final segment, Sandy Veneman is back with part 4 of her series on mind games, where she explains how to up our mental game and improve partnership and performance through simple proven psychological techniques, including cognitive reprogramming and counter conditioning. And the final topic is visualization exercises.
So what we're going to do is called visual imagery. And I start off visual imagery with people with my happy place, which is the beach. So good visualizations use all of your 5 senses. which I always forget what they are, even though I teach it all the time in my physiology class. So the first thing we're going to do is, because I'm real kinesthetic, I always think about what I feel, which is handy when you ride horses, because people who are kinesthetic, what you feel is really nice. I'll go, can you feel that? Can you feel that? And they're like, no. But I feel. So then I'll have to say, well, look down and see what's happening, which is the best. Okay, so visualization. I'm on the beach. Come to the beach with me and feel that the sand underneath you is so nice and cool, and it's kind of conforming to your body. So you're nice and flat now. Just think about that nice flat. You're on the beach. And I can feel the nice breeze over the top of me. And I hate to be cold, which is why I left St. Louis. So I'm on a beach in the south. And so I feel that nice warm breeze, which is a comfortable breeze over me. And so our next sense, because I usually have my eyes closed on the beach, I'm just kind of relaxing. I can hear the palms. You can hear the palm fronds kind of rustle. And they have seagulls. So the little seagulls are, wah! And then the ocean is that nice rhythmic, whoosh, whoosh. And the only sounds on the beach are usually happy sounds. You know, so there's like kids playing. There's not people screaming at each other. So nice, happy sounds. So we've gone through feeling and hearing. The next thing is taste. I do calories don't count on vacation. So I get lemonade made with real lemon and real sugar. So I always taste lemonade in my visualization. Everybody else goes for the booze. So if yours is a margarita, go for it. So we've done kinesthetic, what you feel, what you hear, what you taste. The next thing is going to be what you smell. And so I'm going to choose to smell like gardenias, but it's usually actually smells like rotting dead fish, but I'm just going to pretend like that isn't going to happen. So I'm smelling like nice ocean smells, and gardenias that were always close to that beach where I love to go, or the popcorn stand that also sold that lemonade. And then the next thing is sight. Have I forgotten anything? Okay, so the next thing is sight. So this was, you can keep your eyes closed because you're visualizing, but if I had opened my eyes, all I could see was be the palms kind of swaying and a few little clouds going by. Okay, big deep breath in through your nose, out through your mouth. So if you practice this, I hope you feel a little more relaxed right now. Eventually, you could do a little visualization to go ahead and relax your body too, because if you do it with your progressive muscle relaxation after you've got most of your muscle groups relaxed, again, two things paired together become the same thing. So classical conditioning, if you start your visualization, you can feel your muscles start to relax. And then the last thing I want you to do is to get a key word and whatever is relaxing to you. Some people pick relax. I am not a creative person, but I didn't pick relax. I picked red jello. So my key word is red jello, and that's because I visualized a little square of red jello on top of a saddle, and it always went with the motion of the saddle. It was not stiff. It wasn't like the one I left in my refrigerator for months, okay? Fresh red jello. So if I say red jello to myself, that's a key word. And if you practice it with your relaxation and deep breathing and visualization, eventually you could just say red jello and you get that relaxation. So if you practice it, like I said, in your own bed before you go to bed and you get good at it, then you want to start gradually practicing it in a situation that's closer to being on a horse. But you want the success in some place like your bed to begin with. So once you get really good at it, like I say, then you start moving it into the situation like a horse show and practice it there, because it can become kind of situation specific. I'm actually better at relaxing at a horse show than I am at other places because I just practiced it there. Okay, so one more little talk about imagery. So that was imagery to try to relax yourself. We also use imagery when we ride. And this is very helpful. And I think I have to say this because some people don't. All right, so you can practice your test in your head a whole lot. So you can visualize two separate ways. You can visualize like the eye watching you do the test, or you can visualize from the rider's perspective. Since I'm very kinesthetic, I always visualize from my perspective because I feel my ride as much as I would see my ride. So this is really good if you help beginners or you are kind of a beginner. You have to figure out what the test is going to be like. So you're going to ride every single movement. The important thing is you don't ride mistakes. So you can't go, oh, my horse is going to get freaky and not do that left half pass right. So my left half pass lady, she has to visualize it perfectly done in her visualization, okay? So you're going to ride your entire test and you want to feel what's happening. You're going to actually kind of subtly move your body. You're given different cues and you're going to visualize that your horse responds correctly. So lots of research on this in sports psychology. If you practice things like a tennis swing, not swinging the racket, you just do it visually, they come back on the court and do as well as people that are out there hitting the ball. And some research shows better because you were hitting the ball right in your visualization as opposed to hitting it wrong a lot of the time physically. So practice your test. And another way to visualize, I always mention, because people don't seem to do this, I'm a chunker. Chunking just means you break things into groups. So if I go over my test with somebody before I go in the ring, they're always like, no, you have to halt it. I'm like, yeah, you always halt at X or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, so it's a chunk. You go in and I need to know, do I go right or left? That's the first thing you have to really know. Okay? So it's like left. And then it's like middle letter, do this. End letter, do that. Corner letter, do this. Okay? So you don't have to go from this to this to this. It's like, no, you start that movement in your brain, it's done. You just need to know where to start the next one. And so you can chunk them together in bigger groupings. And that way you might have, I mean, the FEI level tests, they kind of go on for a long time. But if you're at the lower levels, you can chunk most tests into like 5 pieces. And so if you only have to remember 5 things in the test, it's much easier than if you have to remember 20.
And our thanks again to Sandy Veneman for this series that was first recorded at the 2016 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. And finally, we have some reminders on deadlines for you. First of all, applications are now being accepted for 2 instructor-trainer certification exams. The first exam will be held on December the 8th through the 10th, 2017, at Folly Farm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And the second exam will be held on April the 20th through the 22nd in 2018 at River Ridge Stables in Potosi, Wisconsin. Candidate applications are due approximately 8 weeks prior to each exam. And you'll find more information and specific deadlines and details of each of these exams by visiting the website at usdf.org. And the deadline for first place year-end award recipients to submit a photograph for possible inclusion in the yearbook issue of the USDF Connection magazine is October the 27th, 2017. And you can find information about submitting photographs by going to the website at usdf.org under Documents and Awards. And finally, the entries for the US Dressage Finals must be received by midnight Eastern Time on October 26th. You'll find the official prize list on the website for more information. And that's our show for this week. You can download this episode from the iTunes podcast store to any podcast app, such as Podbean or Stitcher. And as always, the latest episode is posted on our social media at Facebook and Twitter. And don't forget, whilst you're on the website, be sure to check out eTrack for more educational information and resources. Until the next time, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.